Make no mistake, this is something. Rest assured, we aren't going anywhere.
That bill, just the conflation of funding for Israel and funding for Ukraine at this point is kind of wild. These are different conflicts. Why are they not being voted on separately? We got to shut the tent cities down, okay? It's 2024. I'm tired.
They're gross.
They're terrible. We don't like tent cities.
I wouldn't discount how much of this is just like, it's fun to be outside in the spring with your friends.
The CEO of NPR, who is, it turns out, a CIA asset.
Yeah. CIA, important. Okay, sure. But I also always look at the New York Times wedding announcement. Obnoxious, ultra elite stuff. I mean, she's from Connecticut, like.
Red flag. Always a red flag. What's up, guys? Welcome back to the pod. We have a special guest today. Again, returning, Liz Wolf. Say hello.
Hey, what's up?
Liz Wolf runs the, is it fair to say you run the newsletters at Reason? I get your newsletter.
The newsletter is essentially like my personal diary that I just sort of like spit out every morning at like 5 or 6 a.m. So like make of that what you will. Reason unfortunately puts it under their own branding. I say unfortunately for them, not for me.
Well, keep up what you're doing. It's one of the few newsletters I actually read. I just unfollowed a bunch today. I won't say which ones, but it rhymes with the Meat Press. Okay. So I want to start with the TikTok bill. Absolutely huge news this week. We've been writing about this and talking about this, I think instigating this, me personally, for a very long time. We have followed every twist and turn of the Xi Jinping controlling a powerful U.S. speech platform in America story. Last you heard from us, we talked about the House vote. So this has since moved on to the Senate. It got somehow insanely mixed in with like funding for Israel and Ukraine and passed the Senate, was signed into law by Biden. That's basically the story is TikTok is now going to be forced by the government to divest. And this is monumental. This has happened before. We've talked about this, you know, in the sense of or we've talked about this in the case rather of Grindr is the last big one. That one, I think in some sense, you know, way easier to defend on national security grounds. It's very obvious why you wouldn't want Xi Jinping to have someone's like gay nudes. The TikTok one is a little bit nebulous on the national security side. It's definitely a spy app, but you know, what information are they getting and what are they using with it? It's a complicated question. Ferocious battle in Washington, but at the end of the day, the Senate vote was overwhelming and bipartisan, which is decisive. And here we are sort of moving forward. I think that there's a question now of who is going to buy this. That has recently been complicated by the fact that the CEO of TikTok, who, again, this is a company that's owned by the parent ByteDance, which is the Chinese company. So the CEO of TikTok is signaling that, or the CEO of ByteDance, rather, is signaling that they are not going to sell the app with the algorithm, which, of course, is like the main part of the app. That says to me that they are never going to sell the app and it will just be shut down completely because China does not want us to know sort of what they've been doing. And it's a valuable asset. You know, the asset, the algorithm is very good and China loves to steal shit, but does not want to share it, which understandable, but also once again proves that China controls the app. And we're going to enter now about 12 months of legal hell. The big winner here is really just TikTok's law firm, whoever is representing them, because it's going to be boatloads of cash for months and months and months up until the final moment that they cannot sell the company, at which point I don't believe they will sell the company. I do believe this thing, or not in its current incarnation, I do think it'll be shut down or effectively shut down. If it's sold, it'll be some way worse version of it that will absolutely, well, not absolutely, but probably fail. And so follow many, many questions about, you know, is this a free speech issue? As like Elon Musk has said, I don't think it is, but interesting. Perhaps our libertarian on the chat can lay down that argument for us today. Is it?
Use slurs like that, Mike.
You know what? I just want to give it to you now. Like I'm not going to list all the possible reasons you bad or good. Liz, what is your take on what has been unraveling? I mean, you've got the sort of, you don't live in DC, but I feel like you're closer to the sort of DC pulse.
Blah. Living in DC would be my worst nightmare. I would immediately myself. No, I think that you, I'm an avid consumer of all of the Pirate Wire's content on this issue. And I think I frequently find myself a little bit closer to the Mike Solana camp than perhaps the Standard Reason camp. But I do think that you are still missing some things. Namely, one thing that I have been thinking about a lot is the degree to which TikTok's user growth has really been plateauing, the degree to which it's sort of becoming an aging platform. It's no longer the sort of playground of the Gen Zs. It's getting a little bit older. And I kind of wonder whether we'll see it become this milquetoast, very shitty app akin to Instagram. We've even seen TikTok shift to attempting to be a little bit more of an e-commerce platform. It's a little bit of a libertarian cop out to say, oh, you know, the natural destructive forces in the market will make it so that this is a non-issue that doesn't really need to be ruled on. But I also do think that every single time, you know, there's been an antitrust concern with regard to Meta and some of these other big platforms, anytime there's this concern about bigness, which to be fair, the TikTok concern is not bigness, it's national security. But anytime there's a concern about a platform's market share, the platform kind of seems to take care of the issue itself by simply failing or by a new scrappy upstart coming onto the scene and stealing its lunch. And I wonder whether we're actually beginning to see some of those things in the works with TikTok, where maybe it won't be as effective of a platform as the people who are concerned about it say. That said, I do think that the way that the algorithm currently suppresses information that is critical of the CCP is something that is concerning to me. I don't know if we have enough evidence to prove that in as airtight of a manner as I would want there to be in order to take such a drastic measure that I find speech suppressing, like a TikTok ban. But also at the same time, the area that I find most convincing is, you know, in the event, like how effective would TikTok be as this mass propaganda dissemination platform in the event of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, for example? I'm less concerned about algorithmic suppression of certain content and more concerned about algorithmic pumping out of propagandistic content that favors the CCP and that could really sort of work. I almost wonder whether they're kind of slow rolling it in a way that would be very consistent with what the CCP does in other areas where they let a little bit of stuff seep through the great firewall sometimes, right? They're very sneaky with making sure that it's not an all or nothing thing. And they know when dealing with an international audience, you don't want to raise American hackles too much. So of course there's a little bit of, you know, Tiananmen Square content available on TikTok. Of course there's a little bit of Hong Kong content available on TikTok. But what happens when they really, really do want to deploy it as this sort of national security tool to change public perception in the US at scale? That's the area that I'm concerned about. So those are just two areas, the e-commerceification and natural possible failure of the platform, as well as my legit concern that it could be used as this mass propaganda dissemination platform. What do you think of that, Mike?
Well, I guess I just don't. So let's say that TikTok was suppressing, I mean, it seems to be suppressing information on like Tiananmen Square or whatever. I don't really
care. It's suppressing a lot of it, but not the entirety of it, right?
Like, yeah, right. In a very sneaky way. I don't want to be sounding like a broken record here because I think I've commented on this quite a bit. I don't care really about that one as much. I think the thing that is really, I think it's a problem to have them controlling a speech platform that is potentially for, you know, 170 million
users in the United States. It's massive. So
It has a huge impact on how we see the world as a nation. That is a problem. It's a very nebulous question and hard to prove and not necessary to prove, in my opinion, because the question of trade reciprocity for me is more than enough. There's the national security question, the spying piece, sure. And that's enough for the bipartisan coalition in Congress that forced divestiture of the app. But one thing I've seen a lot of over the last few days has been this question of, well, how is China going to retaliate? And I thought, like, they have already done that. Like, what do you mean? This is like every one of our social media platforms is banned. Every one of our media companies is banned. I saw someone else say, I made a comment on the fact that it's pretty clear that the CEO of ByteDance wants to not sell the app, which doesn't make any business sense at all. But it does make a lot of sense if you're run by the government. And they said, oh, well, why on earth would he sell you know, a potentially $1 trillion company for $1 billion. It would be as if China gave was going to ban Facebook, but said, you know, or you could take $1 billion. They wouldn't even do it. And it's like, that's not a question, because China did ban Facebook and it happened overnight. There was never, I think it was never an option actually in China. Facebook was banned preemptively, but the companies that they do ban, like the New York Times, are shut down overnight. There's no like, let's force divestiture of like, of the Chinese market or something. It's shut down. And I think that Americans need to at least engage with this idea that every other country in the world seems to be thinking about trade in a very different way than we do. And I don't know. I don't think national security is an important reason. I don't think it's the only reason. I'm glad it happened. But I think that there are many other areas of trade that we should be policing in this way, and sort of demanding reciprocity. So we just saw something from the Biden that signals the Biden administration that signals the opposite, which I wrote about a little bit this week in one of the takes on the Daily, which you guys should check out. You have now our sort of trade watchdog group is changing the way that it approaches this stuff. So historically, all throughout the Obama administration as well, when regulation targeting our companies came from abroad, we would think of ways to push back as a nation. We would at least think. We didn't really do much, but we would think about it, and we would that would be factored into policy and whatnot. They've just sort of they've explicitly said that that's no longer the benchmark. The countries are allowed to regulate our companies however they want, and you know, any regulation, even if it sort of bans a company for whatever reason, is not necessarily an act of trade aggression. That's the opposite way that we should be going, and that's just kind of, you know, where I tether in. Sanjana, what do you think about all this?
I mean, I also find the trade argument compelling. I think it's crazy that China has basically all of our social media apps banned and we allow TikTok to sort of operate freely here. The thing that I found more interesting about the way the bill was passed, though, is how it was sort of tied to foreign aid to Israel and Ukraine, which I found a bit depressing. I mean, I understand that this is how DC operates, but it is kind of crazy that you know, we can't have sort of, you know, Congress just vote on whether or not we should force the divestiture of TikTok. We have to sort of sweeten the pot with these massive transfers of aid, once again, to Ukraine in this, you know, seemingly interminable war. And then, of course, to Israel. And yeah, I mean, it just sort of, because Mike, you were saying it passed by a bipartisan vote. And I sort of wonder, you know, how much of this bipartisan vote actually reflects a kind of genuine conviction on the part of all these Congress people that divestiture is, you know, in the best interests of the American people, whatever that means, and how much of it is just this kind of like, okay, we need to get more money to Ukraine and Israel.
I think that's such a good point. And it also works, like, it works, it's more than TikTok at this, but that bill, just the conflation of funding for Israel and funding for Ukraine at this point is kind of wild. These are different conflicts. Like, why are they not being voted on separately? All of these things should be voted on separately. This is another take of, I think maybe it was Riley that wrote about this one. How are we expected to vote on these things in any kind of reasonable way if they're all lumped together? They're totally different causes and totally different with totally different drawbacks and cases in favor. It is, I agree, depressing.
Well, and specifically the manner in which the Ukraine aid was decided. I mean, I hate reading the Washington Post because it makes me want to particularly like the world of politics, but Washington Post had a really interesting long reported piece that they published, I believe, yesterday, that was talking about how the new House Speaker, Mike Johnson, was essentially kind of bullied by Biden and a lot of congressional leadership into really prioritizing the passage of Ukraine aid. And, you know, for a long time, Johnson has been really, I mean, he's newly in his position, newly minted. He's dealing with a very fractured GOP, a huge component of his party, the far right flank, you know, has been really interested in also adding border spending and getting the border crisis under control to this package of aid bills, which, again, like, more to your point, why is it that we're talking about banning a social media platform, aid to Ukraine, aid to Israel, aid to Taiwan, by the way, and then also apparently getting the entire immigration situation solved in the United States. I mean, it really shows a certain unseriousness on the part of legislators. But you actually read this Washington Post report, which I reported a little bit in this morning's Reason Roundup as well. It's kind of stunning the fact that not only is Johnson not able to really in any way appease this side of his party that is concerned about, you know, government spending run amok, which is something that's a very legitimate concern. Not only that, but he's also trotted into the Oval Office to essentially be kind of bullied and pressured into, you know, passing the Ukraine aid packages. And it's a little bit like, well, at what point does the bill come due? And at what point will genuine dissent actually be entertained and genuine debate sort of emerge? Instead, it's just kind of government spending all the way down and the game of politics, no matter what, no matter the issue, and blending all the issues together quite consistently.
Yes, agree. Brandon, what do you think about that? I think we should really, I think it's an interesting subject of just the conflation of subjects, or I mean, lumping of subjects in together.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like buying a cable package for HBO and you get a bunch of other stuff too, and you just have to pay for HBO and that's the only thing you want. Kind of sucks. I don't have a take on it. It seems depressing, right? So like, it sucks that that's the way our politics work. And I totally agree. We should be voting on these issues separately. They're completely different issues. Israel is not the same as, you know, Chinese foreign influence. And yeah, I don't know how you get out of that. I think it's just like the fact of the matter is that you have these like broad coalitions in US politics. And the only way to pass things nowadays, I guess, is to lump a bunch of issues together and just ram them through.
Now it is, so it is passed. It is signed into law. We have this interesting, so Trump has come out strongly. He was going back and forth on it, and he came out at the last moment sort of strongly against this. Very strange considering he banned it himself in his administration, and that was undone by Biden. So it's,
you
just
gotta love his brass balls though, right?
Which is just to do the opposite of what he once did, yeah. And pretend he never did.
It's, he just doesn't care.
He does not give a shit. He just turned, but so does Biden, right? Like Biden started his term by undoing the ban and is now concluding it by pushing it, signing the bill. So, I mean, we're just living in a world where we're supposed to forget what happened 4 years ago, always in the case of both parties. They are always changing it up. And it's like nobody is grounded in any kind of ethics or morals or values. It's just always a raw game of power. And that is, while depressing, interesting, you know, what is the element of, what is the Trump case for this bill, other than, I guess you have, I mean, you have people who are funding him, who care about TikTok. You have David Sacks now, friend of the pod, is doing, I just read, David's going to be having, fundraiser for Trump, was news, I think, yesterday. And David's been super, all in guys in general have sort of changed their perspective on this. He's been super against the divestiture. He believes it's going to be used. And I think I wrote about this. I think there is an interesting case that the bill itself was maybe too ambiguously crafted. And because of that, we run the risk of some future president banning, for example, Twitter, because they're going to make some nebulous case that Elon is a foreign asset or controlled by a foreign adversary. I broke that down in a piece where I don't think that's necessarily convincing at all, actually. But I think it's worth thinking about. Does Trump really care about that? Does he care about the youth vote? Does he care? What is the Trumpian motivation here? I don't know fully, other than to oppose Biden.
What if he just cares about the David Sacks vote?
It's like he loves the all-in pod. He's going to be on it. I think it could actually be. This is like, I think that we are all more powerful than we think, and the all-in guys have they've really helped change culture. So good on them. They got the ear of the next president. I think. I mean, I think Trump's going to win. Right? He has to. Well, unless it's stolen.
I mean, I have to say, I prefer the so both Trump and Biden are quite transparently just making pleas to you know, Gen Zs to vote for them. And I much prefer Trump's approach, which is like, here, you can have your retarded dancing app, as opposed to Biden's, which is just, we will bankrupt everybody for many generations to come to pay for your basket weaving sociology degree crap from Oberlin, right? Like, one of those is far less objectionable to me than the other, but it's clear what both are.
Yeah. Speaking of the troubled youth, we've got to talk about the sort of Hamas encampment on the grounds of Columbia University and the counter protesters, including that there was a professor who, I don't know if he said it himself, but certainly online, the framing is like he got kicked out of campus because he was Jewish. And like, then I saw this one. So there you have the Hamas chanters and like dancers. And you know what? I should actually bring in a real journalist to tell me about what happened. I believe, Brandon, you were the one who researched this one. Do you want to just break down the Gaza conflict on the grounds of Columbia University that is presently taking place?
Sure. last week, protests erupted around actually NYU also and Columbia. And specifically at Columbia, they set up a tent city on the south lawn of the campus. I feel like both sides are a little bit weird here. But like that Jewish professor, a lot of Jewish people sort of like went into histrionics about this tent city, saying that demonstrators were, you know, yelling anti-Semitic things at Jewish people, threatening language at Jewish students and faculty. I think the New York Times did report this, which so there is a little bit of that going on. And a flashpoint in the tent city, like sort of saga, was a little bit early on when a prominent rabbi sent a WhatsApp message to a group of like hundreds of Jewish Columbia students saying that they needed to stay home from campus because it was not safe. This also coincides with Passover. So Monday was the beginning of Passover. So the Jewish kids were not going to go to campus anyways, I think. But after that, it seems to have sort of motivated the president of Columbia to order all classes to go remote, which she did on Monday.
They're all remote, or there's a remote option?
All remote on Monday. And then the next day she said that the classes would be hybrid, which basically means like you don't have to come to class to attend it, but you can go to class until the end of the school year, which is only next week. So April 29th. So it's not like, you know, we've got months and months of hybrid or remote. It's just like one more week of class. She did this because the president was like, it's too, and you know, we need to like dissolve tensions here. Hopefully with less people on campus, it'll just get better. That apparently didn't work. President called the police, who ended up making 100 arrests a few days ago. But that actually sort of engendered a new wave of enthusiasm, on the pro-Palestinian side. More tents have popped up since then. And it's just kind of, it seems to just be getting more intense.
I guess my first cut on this is just, I'm never in favor of a tent city. I don't care what flag it's waving. We got to shut the tent cities down. Okay. It's 2024. I'm tired.
They're gross.
They're terrible. We don't like tent cities. PyroWire's, I don't like to make official statements on behalf of PyroWire, but I feel like we could say no tent cities.
These kids got nice new tents though. I think they also went to REI last week.
Are you anti-Burning Man? Burning Man's like the original tent city,
well,
right?
Well, that's a temporary tent city and it's in the desert.
All tent cities are temporary if you have the National Guard. No, just kidding.
I guess you're right. it's true. I like some tent cities better than I like tent cities. I'm okay with tent cities. I'll give you this. Tent cities are allowed in the desert. You can do a tent city far away from the city. So they could host the Palestinian tent cities there. I mean, go off. Build a whole Palestinian commune. I'm fine with that. In the desert, far from human civilization. I think there are a couple of funny things about this. The first one is the idea that these protests are uniquely crazy. They're crazy. They're terrible. They're disgusting. I have seen anti-Semitic things. I think probably most people are not that at these protests, but there are unlimited examples of just disgusting like signs and people who do say shitty things about Jews and quoting various like terrorists and things like this. All of it's gross. And can't stand these people. Okay. Now that that's settled, these protests being framed as uniquely terrible in sort of like recent American history is, that's crazy to me. We all lived through BLM, okay? We had 6 months plus of like legalized rioting all the way up from June 2020 all the way up to January of 2021. You had riots. It was January 6th specifically. It was like once the crazy Trump people did it, shut it down. Rioting was no longer legalized. And that was the end of it. That was the end of the sort of summer of rioting. Those were crazy months and nobody was speaking up. Nobody was questioning it. Nobody was saying, hey, maybe there's like a racist element to any of this or whatnot. And that's because culture was just very different at that moment. And we have since sort of memory hold that entire period of history. But it's been sort of surreal to watch what really appears to be a fraught debate over this topic kind of in America that is now able to even be voiced in a way that before debates were not able to be voiced. And then I think just like even in the sort of pantheon of leftist tensities, this is an inferior tensity. I was in New York in 2008 through like 2011. Brandon, I think you were there too. We lived through Occupy Wall Street. Those were some fucking tensities all over the country. It was the Occupy movement. And my sense is those were like way crazier. No, I mean, Brandon, do you remember that?
Totally. And they were facing the winter. So I think they started in the fall and they actually did go through some of the winter. They ended up, it thinned the intensity out, the winter did, because New York City is obviously pretty harsh. But yeah, it's also, you know, the end of the school year is right here. And I think half of these students probably have plane tickets home, you know, like are literally already bought them, you know? So I mean, we'll see where we are in a week, I think, basically. Well, yeah, right? Like where they got to go home, right? Like they are going to go Hamptons. Home. And then there's going to be no other students to see them doing what they're doing, which will be a problem for them too, right?
They'll be protesting on Martha's Vineyard. Sanjana, you went to school with these people. Can you kind of help me understand the psychology here?
I mean, I think part of this is just there's like a party element, to be honest. Like you're tenting, you're camping with your friends in nice weather. And I mean, I think it's nice 100%. In New York right now. You guys, Liz and Mike, you can confirm. But I mean, yeah, I think there's a lot of hysterics on both sides right now. I find the aesthetics of the tent city kind of disgusting. I was just thinking, like, are they sleeping in there? I guess they're going back to their dorm rooms to shower or something. These are like the questions that immediately came to my mind. But in terms of like what the psychology is, I do think there's, there's a portion of this that's just like they're probably really underworked. I would imagine that after COVID, like the academic standards that fell really significantly, and I lived through that, where like classes were remote, everyone was cheating on exams, classes were pass fail, like this whole sort of dumbing down of a kind of already dumbed down set of academic standards, I think has continued. And I wouldn't be surprised if, like, you know, final exams are also hybrid or something like that, which students love because it means that you don't actually have to study very hard for them. I mean, I think there's, you know, they're probably underworked. Some of them probably do care a lot about the conflict. But I wouldn't discount how much of this is just like, it's fun to be outside in the spring with your friends and like feel like you're part of a political cause while also not really, I don't know, making that many sacrifices in your everyday life.
That's a take that I had written down for this too, which is like protesters in general would be wise to like always try to distinguish their protests from a party. And this one feels like there's not much of a distinction. If not only because one of their demands, like there's five demands that they have. I looked on their website, and one of them is that they don't face any consequences from the school for protesting.
And well, I feel like they're trespassing, they're camping on the lawn and they were told not to. They're breaking the law is actually. Yeah.
Well, so what I don't understand, I actually don't understand the difference between this protest and a party if there are no consequences, right? Like I think a protester should be like, they should ask for consequences. That's the whole reason that's the whole power of a protest is you're going to sacrifice something because you believe so much in this cause that you're protesting. And they're actually just, they're they're dismissing that possibility, which makes it a lot less serious. It's a pro-Palestine themed party. That's what it is.
This is the common thread to all of it, right? It's the same as the 12-hour hunger strike, which like I do all the time. It's called sleeping and then skipping breakfast because you're busy with work, right? Like that's a normal thing to do. It's the same with the Vanderbilt student throwing a fit over how she needed assurances that if she goes to the bathroom to remove her tampon, which by the way, what a disgusting thing to be talking about on camera and disseminated among hundreds of thousands of people. Like, my God, have some self-respect. But talking about how she needs to be able to go to the bathroom and, you know, be assured that she won't be arrested and she can return because otherwise she'll face toxic shock syndrome. And like all these things, it's the same thing over and over again where you see, and I was actually thinking about this with regard to why are these protesters so hellbent on masking all the time, especially if it's essentially a party, right? Like you don't, this isn't actually a thing. It's an aesthetic commitment. It's something to show that you're at the vanguard of something leftist, right? But they were also talking about how, you know, it's a means, like the excuse that they so frequently use is it's a means of covering your face, hiding from surveillance, ensuring that you won't be caught, ensuring that you won't be doxxed, all these things. And it's just over and over again, it's like they want to be perceived as embattled, and yet they're not actually willing to sacrifice anything in order to show that they are committed to these causes. So it leaves all of the rest of us who've seen other protest movements or who are just goddamn adults feeling a sense of like, you are incredibly whiny children, right? You have no sense of what it actually looks like to give up something. You want to draw comparisons between hunger strikes and apartheid South Africa. Yeah, guess what? 12 hours ain't gonna fly. That just doesn't cut it. And I don't think that they have enough context to understand that.
Or, you know, I mean, they're just dumb kids doing dumb kids stuff. Like this sort of, we've all seen versions of this, and maybe the mistake we're making is framing it as in some way novel when really the novel thing was 2020. That was crazy. It was an historical anomaly. It was BLM was happening inside of inside of COVID, and everyone was locked down. That was crazy. That was a moment of real potential calamity, even for the country, that, you know, irreparable calamity. This is just back to sort of business among dumb kids in college. One dumb kid, I forgot. I can't believe it wasn't even on my list. And it occurred to me while Sanjay, you were talking, we've got to talk about Ilhan Omar's daughter. We just like have to talk about her. So she is going to Columbia.
Barnard.
So that's the lesser Columbia?
Lady Brain Columbia. Columbia for girls. Columbia for the gals.
So the Columbia for girls only, girls only Columbia, got it. So she is going there. She's arrested for trespassing because she was in the tent city, right? And she wouldn't leave. I'm pretty sure she was in the tent city. Certainly she broke the law and got arrested. Ilhan Omar, obviously proud of that. I specifically want, we're talking about aesthetics and the aesthetics of protest. Brittany, you're saying it's a Palestine theme party. Agree. Like clearly the way these people look is very important. Ilhan Omar's daughter, and forgive me, I don't know her name.
Hirsi, I believe.
So yeah. Hirsi Omar looks like a leftist college sort of protester. Her glasses specifically haunt me in my sleep. Okay, those glasses that she's wearing, like I have never seen those glasses on a girl in my life. That did not lead to me being yelled at for something. Okay, like these glasses, it's like, of course she has those glasses. Like that was the most expected thing I saw. I feel like I said on you basically, I think that as a man, when you see those glasses, you have just two real options there. It's like you either run away or you just apologize. Like you don't even need, you don't have to even wait for her to say, you just, I'm sorry. It was my fault. I take all of the blame for everyone in my lineage. Even I apologize. It's either sexism, it's racism, it's the environment, but it's those glasses. I'm telling you.
You could also satisfy them by like becoming a eunuch in a performative manner in front of them, or self-immolation. I think they also tend to really like. So you have a lot of options, Mike.
They're like bug cat eye glasses. This is like I'm wearing glasses. This is like I'm a communist. You know what I mean?
That's got to be the thumbnail right there for the YouTube YouTube video.
I think the best thing about this was that the Daily Beast wrote that whole article that interviewed Hersey, I guess, whatever her name is. And it was so focused on, you know, the Daily Beast did such a good job promoting it, basically to optimize for hate clicks, talking about how, you know, she was, you know, going hungry and she was unhoused. And it was this whole thing. And it really, to me, at least, there's a little bit of a meta narrative there, which is that the Daily Beast is so obviously a failing media, like media outlet, right? Because this is the only thing really left for them, right? Like in the post-Vice world where all of these sort of new media organizations have fallen, the Daily Beast is just basically doing this thing that they obviously know is going to get roasted on Twitter. And that's really the only way they can get clicks because nobody gives a shit about them anymore.
Wait, I just saw, this is really rich. Daily Beast aggregated that quote from a Teen Vogue article.
Really?
Which that's where she gave, Ellen's daughter gave the quote to Teen Vogue, which is very apt.
I forgot. I didn't know that Teen Vogue was still around.
I have no idea. I'm finding this out today.
I know that they were
the kitty communist site these days.
Right. Yes. It was like the Death Star of this stuff, but that was
always years has ago. Been. Yeah.
Always has. Yeah. But that was years ago. That was not, I mean, I didn't think that they were still up to their antics. I think it's probably time to move on. So, you know, the intensity of it all had a close analog in recently, just was it 2 weeks, less 10 days ago ish. You had a bunch of also on behalf of Palestine protesters who employed by Google went into a manager at Google's office, locked themselves inside and demanded that the company stop working with Israel. And this, while, you know, not a surprising request from the pro-Palestine protesters, you know, divestment is something they like a lot in the context of Israel, less so in the context of China. It is shocking in a company. It's like the idea that you're going to lock yourself inside of your boss's office and have like a hunger strike until they do what you want is very, that is very of the moment only over the last 5 years, let's say. That's an aberration in the world of business. Google, to everyone's surprise, the sort of house that built crazy, decides to have these people arrested and then fired along with a bunch of other protesters who were protesting at the office in both New York City, or I believe it was New York City and down in right outside of San Francisco. And I think it was Mountain View is their office. So what you have here is a very interesting shift, which we've talked about. At tech, where suddenly Google is, they said in a blog post following all of this, mission oriented. I wrote a piece this week on the mission first sort of policy that was created by Brian Armstrong of Coinbase. This happened 4 years ago when workplace activism, so people protesting things like or walking out even of the office on behalf of things like, for example, systemic racism or sexism, first became popular. And then it was very shocking because we had seen, you know, strikes and walkouts before all throughout the history of business, but typically, you know, on behalf of labor, not on behalf of unrelated political issues. And that had really consumed tech for a lot of years. Then came the mission first philosophy. Then came a pretty slow and then rapid cultural shift in tech. I think that probably coincided mostly with the economic downturn, at least within tech. The bull market, the 14-year bull market crashed, the relationship between managers and employees changed, and the bullshit ended. It was back to business. But Google was the last bastion of that, it seemed, of the crazy, and now it's over. It feels quite significant. So yes, like you have crazy people on college campuses. No, they seem to not be permitted anymore at our companies, or at least our tech companies. Have you guys followed this at all? And what do you make of it?
I think the one premise that is worth like diving into or double clicking on of your piece, Mike, is that Google's move does mark the end of this era or the beginning of a new era. I'd love to hear you, like, I don't know, expand on that. Cause I think that's the only sort of like vulnerable point of this article. It's like it could be, who knows what's going to happen in the next few years?
Well, I think certainly, you know, Jessica Livingston, co-founder of Y Combinator, wrote a piece in 2017 called The Sound of Silence. And at that point, you know, Me Too is happening. Sanjay, you're working on a piece now that's kind of even predates Me Too. Tech had been experiencing a silencing for a while, a cultural silencing. People were not supposed to speak out in any way against what was becoming a fairly loud political point of view that was not only being shared online, but was expected to be shared by the company itself, not just company statements, but policy in keeping with fairly leftist political dogma. She didn't say all that in her piece. What she said was, we're not allowed to talk. We're not allowed to dissent. We're not allowed to share controversial ideas. That seems to be getting worse. And what's going to happen is people are going to stop talking. And once people stop talking, you're going to stop knowing what people really think. And that's going to be a problem for tech. The worst was yet to come. She was correct about everything. What followed was about a 7-year period of silence that lasted, I would say, up until the moment that Elon Musk walked that sink into the halls of Twitter and took it over. And because of that, because you were not allowed any kind of political dissent without getting absolutely murdered by people online, largely amplified by the press that followed tech and hated it and agrees, generally speaking, with the politics of, you know, the far left inside of the companies, you were locked in this sort of strange stasis where political activists had way more power than ever before because they were the only people allowed to speak. Once things changed on the speech side, you know, silence was thawed, people were able to sort of speak against whatever part of that philosophy they didn't like. The whole thing kind of collapsed. And one by one, companies banned the activism altogether from the workplace and chose this different approach of only allowing people to, only allowing the company to sort of take political positions on that impacted the actual business of that business. So in Coinbase's case, it would have been like crypto legislation or things like this. That was tech silent winter. I think within that you had the dawn of workplace activism. I think workplace activism and really authoritarianism and this effort to sort of take control of these companies and actually use them for political purposes in the country and everything from, divesting from Israel in this case to, speech policing across our social media platforms in favor of one or two, very narrow political viewpoints was possible. And I think it's less possible now that we're able to speak is basically what I did. We also interviewed, I had some quotes from Brian Armstrong in there on his advice from Google. And we talked to DHH of Basecamp who followed Brian and he revealed sort of his whole process of changing his mind on this stuff and taking the very difficult decision in the early days of becoming mission first, which, you know, came with a lot of press hatred. Pretty interesting stuff. I would check it out. I think it's especially interesting that Basecamp, what really triggered him, and I think a lot of people in tech had a similar version of this, but he was at his office, or not his office, he had discovered while working with one of his employees that they had been screening potential clients based on their politics online. They were going onto their social media accounts and trying to see who they voted for in determination of whether or not they would work with them. And David is like pretty left-leaning Scandinavian type anti-big tech person. That's what he was known for. And he suddenly realized like wow.
A work-life balance guru type, like really yes. Very yes. Zen, you know, yes. Like that is who he is.
He's from Denmark, like that's yeah. Just how they do
for better and worse.
And that was the moment that he realized this was not like some peace-loving anti-authoritarian group of people that had taken over all these companies. This was an actual authoritarian force of darkness, and he had a choice. It was either neutrality or become a thing that he hated, and he chose neutrality.
I covered this a fair amount back when it happened, both the Coinbase, the Brian Armstrong decision, and DHH's statement at Basecamp. And I actually went on the New York Times podcast, The Argument, to literally debate this with somebody. And the thing that was so interesting to me, and I think you made this point too in your piece, Mike, is there was always this expectation, and DHH has actually made this point a bunch of times, there was always this expectation that what these big founders needed to do in the face of employee workplace activism was listen, you know, take a step back. You know, re-examine their priors, and they just need to listen. But the thing that never went said, and my debating opponent for the New York Times made this case over and over to me.
Who was it?
God, I'm totally forgetting him. He was such a nobody. And New York Times really, I think, inappropriately edited parts of that debate. I think I still came out looking good, but I was really frustrated by how it's like they culled my strongest points and, you know, boosted his points that they agreed to. Like, I don't know. I felt like it was very lopsided. But regardless, the thing that is always goes unsaid is it's not just that these CEOs need to listen. It's that they also need to come to the prescribed conclusion, right? Yes. You don't have the option available to listen and say, yep, I'm going to weigh the available evidence. I'm going to sift through it. Yep, fair enough. I'm going to be humble and reflective. But no, actually, I still am on board with the political priors that I had previously held, right? Like that's not available. There's always this implicit thing, which is you must come around to their point of view. And legitimately, it is such an authoritarian speech environment where any sort of dissent is not tolerated. And the choice to opt out is also, you know, infrequently tolerated by these employee activists. But that was always the component to me that felt like the biggest tell, where it's not just about listening. It's not just about trying to encourage, to foster an environment of humility and discourse, which I would be totally on board with if so. It is about compelling people to engage in certain types of speech and have certain viewpoints, and to cull all of the dissent, suppress it, squelch it, and ensure that it never sees the light of day. It's a really fucked up approach to speech, and it's incredibly inappropriate to have this in the workplace at all. I mean, nothing but respect. I wish Google had come to this conclusion about a decade earlier, but you know, better late than never. I feel the same way with Bill Ackman sort of like waking up to DEI is a problem, where I'm a little bit like, I don't know how much grace to extend to these people. On one hand, I'm like, better late than never, but also like, I don't know, a lot of people have been saying this for the better part of 10 years, right? Like, if only we could have stopped more of this in its tracks. I guess my plea to Ackman, to Google, to all of these people is like, pay attention to these things as they emerge earlier on. And that's a way we can really try to almost de-escalate these psychotic culture wars, right? And everybody wins out when you do that. But don't kind of wait and put it on simmer and wait and wait and wait for it to become this thing that reaches this boiling point.
Yeah, the Ackman stuff is more annoying than that, because he's not just only now learning about it. He's like, I'm going to tell you guys about this crazy thing that's happening that you don't know about. He's over here trying to explain to, he's like, did you guys know about wokeness? Did you know that this existed? Like, have you heard about this shit?
And the corollary to this is Mark Cuban also being like, actually, I don't know. Diversity is awfully nice in this very like Obama era thing where it's just like, dude, wake up. Where have you been for 15 years?
That's what,
like,
David talked at DHH, talked about Cuban specifically. And he's like, I've got to give this guy some grace because he is sort of clearly just learning about, he's like, equity, that sounds,
it's a little cute, right?
It's like, we love equality, right? They're the same thing, aren't they? It's like, oh dude, you're just so rich that you've not like been in the swamp with us. Like, you have no idea how crazy this shit has gotten. And then maybe a little bit with Cuban is also like, once he realized he had to save face, and there's no saving face because his position was just so stupid. But I don't know, Sanjana, Brandon, what do you guys think about this?
The thing I can't get over with the Google employees in general is just their level of entitlement. Cause I'm like, I understand college students agitating for their administration to take certain steps because they're paying, you know, to go to the school, or they're on scholarship or whatever. But, you know, somehow they are, the administration is in some ways indebted to them. But to like have a struggle session at your employer's office as if you can't just leave, you can leave the company, right? Like, you can just go to another company. And a lot of these people, it's like they're software engineers, they're product managers. It's not like this is a really small field where they can't find a company that aligns with their values. They just don't want to take a pay cut, I presume, or a benefits cut. And I just, there's no world in which I can understand like the logic of trying to force your employer to change their political opinions. It just seems, really entitled. And it kind of, one thing that was interesting, at some point, someone on here like confused the students and the Google employees. And it's like, they are kind of the same, they're the exact same person. It's like this weird, they're in this protracted adolescence where I think in their mind, they think of their employer as their university administrators, and they're bringing that same mindset to work. And I'm glad that Google is finally disabusing them of it definitively by firing them. So they'll have to find a new job.
I think also about how much like American culture has really like fostered that notion, right? Like we've entirely created this environment, whether it's Vox instituting their 2-drink limit for their Christmas party to ensure there's no funky workplace sexual harassment or like anyone making a pass at, you know, another adult that they have things in common with, right? Like whether it's, I think there's like such a parallel between the like Title IX, you know, attempting to adjudicate all manner of sexual miscommunication on college campuses. And then the fact that a whole crop of people graduated and came into these workplaces, maybe not at Google, but at a whole bunch of other places, and kind of wanted to do the same whole rigmarole all over again, where it was like, oh, so-and-so made an unkind comment about my appearance or whatever, and wanted to report it as if there's like a Title IX, an overpaid Title IX bureaucrat available for them, you know, each and every moment. And I guess to some degree, like bloated HR departments kind of gave them that message, right? Like, can you fault them for understanding that this is just kind of, it's like weaponized grievances as a means of distracting from actual work all the way down, regardless of where you are.
It was a talent war. So you had this massive bull run in tech starting around 2008 up until what, like 2 years ago when the crash sort of everything came tumbling down, or a year ago about. That meant that, and Google sort of famously embodied this, you had to give these people whatever they wanted and more than they could even possibly dream. These places actually were a lot like college campuses. You know, you had dining halls that was like breakfast, lunch, dinner paid for. You had your transportation covered with Wi-Fi. You had all sorts of strange, Google famously fighting with like Facebook for talent, offering the craziest perks imaginable, everything from like massages, and you had your coffee shop and your beautiful gym, your laundry service in some cases, to literal nap pods in the case most famously of Google. They were also sleeping there. It was like their dorm. That I think bred a different relationship with their companies over the years. People identified with them more, which worked for the companies. You know, they wanted these people to identify with them. Google wanted to just hire every single talented person that existed as a sort of preemptive tactic to suppress innovation everywhere else. Insidious, but topic for a different pod, I think. They did a great job of it up until very recently, when the sort of world changed, and it changed most, I think, for these employees. You don't hear about these perks anymore because they don't really exist. It's a lot, way less of that today. You know, there were so many pieces making fun of the way that we treated tech workers 10 years ago. All of the perks, endless think pieces about the perks, and it's kind of over. And I think that the activism, in a way, less so than sort of workplace wokeness or whatever, it's like that stuff, the activism is almost a perk. It was like, this is not just a workplace. This is this other thing. This is like,
it's bring your whole self to work type culture.
That was one of the perks that the companies were offering, right? These people weren't just doing it. Like the companies were offering that, and the offer has been rescinded. So sorry, guys, it's back to the computer.
I think it also speaks to how flush with cash some of these companies are. I mean, imagine if we had a work stoppage that was like 2 weeks long. Like you're just burning like so much money every single day that people aren't working. It's like you're never going to see that again. And this went on during Floyd era 2020. You know, I'm aware of one company that whose story has never been told. Where work stopped for like a good 2.5 months for struggle sessions every single day. And it's like, how do you, if you don't have a bunch of investment capital, how do you survive something like that? You know, and it's interesting that Google and other companies can actually tolerate this from a financial perspective. And I think it just goes to show how actually powerful of a position they have in tech.
Yeah. And maybe that the richness that Google is the richest, man. They are a money printing machine. And maybe that it's just that simple. You're right. It's like they just had the most money. And so this shit persisted there the longest. I do want to make some space for the CEO of NPR, who is, it turns out, a CIA asset, Sanjana. Take it away.
She may be a CIA agent. She certainly seems to be an asset. I mean, this is based on this is based on Chris Rufo. Chris Rufo's reporting. He basically published an article in City Journal, I think it was yesterday or a couple days ago, pointing out that Catherine Marr, the new CEO of NPR, has in her previous life working at NGOs in the Middle East, sort of weirdly hewed closely to a lot of revolutions happening around the time of the Arab Spring. And she was like in the right place at the right time in a lot of cases. So, I mean, first of all, she got a degree in Islamic studies and Middle East studies at NYU.
I remember, and I was told in college, if I wanted to be a CIA agent, that was the direction to go.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, there is kind of this lore. Everyone I know who studied like Arabic in college was either like a second gen Muslim kid who wanted to learn the language or something, or wanted to join intelligence services. So she studied that. But then between like 2011 and 2013, she was in, she was in Libya, Tunisia. She was at the Turkish and Syrian border at a bunch of times. And there was,
as one does, right? Like, who among us?
She's like the Forrest Gump of like color revolutions in every single one.
She wrote blog posts, about sort of, she was writing blog posts about getting internet connection to Benghazi. I mean, she basically seems to have been working for NGOs that had very close connections to the CIA, including one called the National Democratic Institute, which I guess former CIA employees have said, yes, has very close connections to the intelligence community. And Chris Rufo's point is basically, you know, she seems to have in some ways been involved in fomenting these like pro-liberal democracy revolutions abroad, and then at home come back and fomented our own color revolution, as he says, in the George Floyd protests through her work at the Wikimedia Foundation, sort of pushing this left-wing, you know, racialist ideology. And he talks about gender ideology as well. I mean, I personally think the thing I find interesting about this is like whether or not she's actually part of the CIA, it's kind of, she's like indistinguishable from a CIA agent in her work at these NGOs. And also a lot of the reporting he did was based on her tweets. Like he just went through her Twitter and found there's like a tweet of hers from 2011 where she's like, I'm heading to the Turkish Syrian border tomorrow. And so it's not even like, you know, she was hiding her movements. This is all publicly available information. So yeah.
Does Rufo allege a formal affiliation with the CIA, or does one have to have
Rufo's strategy is just, he's just asking questions.
He's just asking questions. He actually says it's like, it's irrelevant whether or not she is formally affiliated with the CIA, which I do agree with. I mean,
you think it's irrelevant?
I think it's irrelevant to the fact that she clearly, I guess his broader point seems to be like she's part of this, you know, NGO apparatus that seems to be ideologically aligned with the CIA. So in that sense, it's like, okay, they're working toward the same end goal. I guess it's relevant in that, yeah, it's crazy if we have a CIA agent at the head of NPR.
Heading up the state media.
Yeah. So, right. That's true.
My take on this is just, I don't think we should let anybody with a New York Times wedding announcement take on a position of power in the American media, because I think it's the most cringe fucking thing on the entire planet. So that's one of the things that I always Google. Like if I'm doing my own little Rufo thing of digging up dirt. Yeah. CIA, important. Okay, sure. But I also always look at the New York Times wedding announcement, because you can always find little nuggets as to like, not only who they are, but also how rich they are and how they present themselves, right? And so there's one little nugget about her first date with her now husband, and how, you know, she wasn't sure whether she was interviewing him to be her counsel, her general counsel or not. And it's just like the type of just like moneyed, obnoxious, ultra elite stuff. I mean, she's from Connecticut. Like, you know, who can really
red
blame
flag.
Her?
Always a red flag.
Right? But it's just like this type of thing where it's like, I know that she styles herself this, you know, woke racial justice warrior, but can you actually be that if you're fundamentally a rich girl from Connecticut, right? And I'm always interested in the class frame of all of this, because how representative is NPR actually going to be if they have Connecticut fancy New York Times wedding announcement CIA shill working for them and taking all of the taxpayer money, right? Like, this is not something we need.
If she was actually a CIA agent and she was out there reporting from all these revolutions, like on the ground, I think I would be much more interested in listening to NPR. Definitely like tune in at least once to see her topple a government. That's that. I mean, I don't know that I agree with it, but you can't say it's not interesting. and also isn't that like, I mean, that is her biggest problem. That's all of their problem, is that they're not these charismatic, scary people. Actually, if this is the face of the CIA and she's, you know, up at a TED talk talking about, I mean, you can listen to one of her speeches. It is just nonsense, buzzword after buzzword after buzzword, to conclude with some kind of boring platitude that means nothing. It's innocuous bullshit. It's like with a veneer of niceness to it.
It's like a Brene Brown who likes foreign policy, right? Like, it's totally boring, you know?
And that's just, if that's the face of American power, then I don't know. I'm a little bit worried about that. Just as someone who doesn't want us to be, you know, destroyed, like, that's troubling that if she actually is the kind of person who's in charge, that's like, I mean, that's in some sense worse than if she isn't. I confused myself there. She sucks. Brandon, finishing thoughts.
I hate to fall back on cliches, but I'm not surprised that she's the prototypical blob person.
Where did that come from? The blob thing.
The blob?
Yeah.
I don't know. I was just asked to comment on it like years ago, a few years ago.
I think it's just slang. It's like the swamp. It's just slang for the foreign policy establishment.
Yeah. And like the media, I think the mainstream, I include the people in mainstream media who have all the right opinions, current thing members.
So, but that alone goes back to my thought a second ago. So the blob versus the deep state is just a totally different thing. A few years ago, we were talking about the deep state. That was scary. That was like, oh my God, spooky. Like, they're controlling the world. They know about aliens for sure, but also they're secretly running the country. There is no stopping them. They can't be removed. They are taking down a president. And now it's just the blob. And
no, it's distinct. The blob is the elite managerial class, and the deep state is the deep state. The two different things, okay. I think. Yeah. But my point was to say that I was looking into Wired magazine for an article that it seems like I'll never end up writing.
I know, I'm still waiting for it.
I know. And every single person is the blob. It's impressive how they seem to hire every single person is like, I previously worked at the New York Times, Washington Post, and then I was like, you know, at some NGO, right? And I think my point is to say that, what's her name? Catherine Marr is not a unique type of person in media today. I think you could look into a lot of people and find the same sort of affiliations or connections or past.
Yeah, everybody's like a nameless, shapeless, Fulbright, Middle East, whatever, Arabic language expert, TED Talk bitch, right? Like, from Connecticut, right? Like, that's just everybody.
Liz, I want to give you the last word, actually, as our guest today. I want to give you an interesting, I guess it's just, if you were in the CIA asset shoes right now, how would you fix NPR?
Well, I mean, the way to really sabotage it from the inside as a libertarian. That's the fix for a libertarian. It's just stunning to me that NPR still receives taxpayer dollars, right? People want to continually diminish this. They receive a hefty chunk of funding from not only directly from the federal government, a few percent, but then also like 10% of their funding is from their member stations, which are directly funded by the government, right? And so, you know, you can tally it up all kinds of different ways, but a chunk of it is actually legitimately coming from taxpayers. I don't think that this is needed. I don't think it was ever needed. And it's kind of stunning to me that this continues to exist. I mean, one thing that NPR really could benefit from is, instead of just being these like anodyne milquetoast sort of like liberal generic shills for the state. If they actually wanted to invest in any scrappier type of reporting, that would be good. I think sometimes their foreign bureaus are pretty solid. You actually, you know, it pains me to say it, but like New York Times also has some really good foreign reporting. NPR could beef up their department there and attempt to make itself useful in some way. I also think, you know, their radio and podcast products, you know, can remain quite good. And so investing in that realm, I think, would probably be excellent. But the main thing I would do if I were Catherine Marr with the, you know, beautiful curls in charge of NPR is I think I would probably commit arson and try to burn it all down because it's really such a waste of all of our money. And all of us should feel we should wake up a little bit angry about this every day. It's okay if you don't want to choose violence the way that I do. But I do actually think that like it is a terrible problem. And we continue to see as the media landscape sort of becomes more and more of this desiccated husk and more newsrooms fall, not to arson, but to natural causes, there continues to be this drum that gets beaten by all kinds of like sadist journalist shills that are like, oh, well, we need taxpayer funding for local news. We need investments in local news. And it's like, I don't know if you understand this, but when the government in any way funds journalism, that journalism will not be adversarial to the government. We want journalism that is adversarial to the state. We want journalism that you know, does legitimate muckraking on power wherever it may be. And when the government funds it, it ain't it, right? Like that's not how that happens. And any journalist worth their salt should be aware of that.
Well, I think we're going to, I think we're going to see, but for the reason that we talked about earlier, or the topic that we talked about earlier, where you can never in Congress vote for just one thing. That's how NPR is funded. It's it's like snuck into all these other bills that people can't say no to. So we'll probably never get a vote just on NPR. And until we do that, then it lives on another day. But we will be here to make fun of it. It's been real. See you guys next week. Probably a day later next week because I'm going to be abroad. And it's going to be hard. So bear with us.
For the CIA or for someone else?
At the border of Tunisia.
The government.
Are you going to be at the Syrian border?
I'll be in Barcelona instigating a movement for independence quietly, but I'm going to tweet about it. Bye.